I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'll admit that it's sometimes hard for me to turn on the radio in the morning and hear about the latest attack on reproductive rights. Never mind the Republican primaries, I was already plenty irked over the last couple of years as the FDA refused to enable adolescents to acquire over-the-counter emergency contraception. Now that I've read Heather Munro Prescott's new book, The Morning After, A History of Emergency Contraception in the United States, which came out with Rutgers University Press in 2011, I have a better understanding of the issue. The book made me realize, for example, that getting OTC sales at all was a great victory. And the book gave me a great sense of the many actors involved in the story, from medical professionals to donors who sponsored unpopular research to feminist healthcare advocates. Heather Munro Prescott is a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. Join us as we speak to her about her new book. Hi, Heather.
Yes.
I'm glad to have you here today. We're going to talk about Heather Munro Prescott's new book, The Morning After, A History of Emergency Contraception in the United States. So thanks for joining us, Heather.
You're welcome.
Heather, why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about your own background? How did you get into this line of work? How did you come to write the kind of stuff you write about?
Well, my training is in science and technology studies at Cornell University. So I've always been interested in women's health issues, history of reproductive rights, reproductive technology. My dissertation and first book was on the history of adolescent medicine, and that book very much dealt with issues of young women's health as well as young men's health. But I spent a good portion of the book talking about adolescent gynecology and reproductive rights. And then my second book, Student Bodies, continued that discussion into the college age. And the current book is in some ways things that didn't make it into Student Bodies, but also I thought it was an issue that deserved its own book. And so it sort of took on a life of its own.
Yeah, and you talk a little bit actually in your introduction about the genesis of the book as a single conference paper, and then several people said we really need a book on the topic.
Yes, that was very encouraging.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of this drug. You take us all the way back to the 1920s with discussion of hormonal therapies around problems like infertility. How does this all tie in?
Well, the study of infertility and the study of contraception are kind of opposite sides of the same coin. And it's important to recognize that even the research on what became the original contraceptive pill was a byproduct of larger interests in infertility and how the female reproductive system worked. And I'd like to remind readers that there was a lot of technological innovation, political activism, introduce a complex cast of characters whose ideas shaped what became to be known as emergency contraception. So I try to do both a scientific history and a popular history, a political history, and so forth to try and give a more complex and nuanced view of the history of this particular drug.
So in these early days, you have to take the history way back to the early days of laboratory experimentation, in a sense you've got the scientists on the one side with their agenda, but you also have people like Martha Sanger, and you have feminists who are providing important financing, right?
Right, yes. It's important, of course, to recognize Margaret Sanger, and I just reread Ellen Chesler's Woman of Valor. I signed it for my graduate history seminar, and it's just important to recognize how much work that Margaret Sanger did in terms of laying the ground for the pill and also contraceptive research more generally, and more importantly, getting lots of bucks to finance birth control research at a time when no government or non-governmental organization would touch it.
So we have so let's get us then from these days of sort of experimenting with drugs for infertility to, as you say, a kind of a byproduct. And of course, there's a relationship between what we now call the pill, that is regular oral hormonal contraceptives, and the emergency contraception pill, What's that relationship?
Well, shortly after the pill was introduced in the United States, and my story looks almost exclusively at the United States and a little bit at Canada. So the story is different based on different geographic regions. But shortly after the pill was introduced in the United States, there were starting to be reports about side effects. There was concerns about taking a drug for a long period of hormonal drug for long periods of time. There were reports that women had failure rates that were not consistent with experimental results. So basically, not long after the pill was introduced, there was some concerns about how to deal with what was called noncompliance or user error. And two of the original scientists who worked on the pill, Gregory Pincus and his associate Minxue Shang, started talking about what they called after-the-fact contraception or morning after pills, day before pills. There's a pretty flippant article by Minxue Shang where he talks about the next innovations are going to be even more precise and won't have to worry about whether, and in some ways it's kind of an insulting view of women that they're these imperfect and experimental subjects, and that women for various reasons can't be trusted to take their pills on time, or they're conflicted about whether they want to be pregnant or not. And then there's the whole issue of women with less education or adolescent girls and what to do about those particular patient populations. So there's kind of a mixture of benevolence and paternalism and in some ways outright sexism that is part of the story. So it's, in other words, it's not a uniform story of uniform progress. There's lots of bumps and side tracks along the road.
So what we have is the development of the pill, and from the scientific community, from the medical community, some skepticism about whether women are going to use it properly.
Correct.
All right. On the one hand, you've got maybe lesser educated women, poor women, African American women who you know just might not know how to use their medications properly, at least in the eyes of the medical establishment. And then also presumably white middle class women who, like you say, the medical establishment thinks they might be ambivalent.
Right.
And thus, quote, accidentally forget to take their pill.
Right.
And it's in this environment in which the notion of emergency contraception becomes important. Let's talk about terminology actually for just a minute, because of course many people know this medication colloquially as the morning after pill, but of course that suggests a very certain timeline, and the more correct term would be emergency contraception.
Yes, and then the term emergency contraception emerged at a particular moment in the drug's history. The scientists who developed what became known as emergency contraception usually used the scientific term postcoital contraception to indicate that this was a drug that was taken after unprotected intercourse. And the popular press in the 60s decided that postcoital contraception was too cumbersome and not easily understood by a general audience. And so quickly the morning after pill got coined, even in some of the more general medical periodicals aimed at general practitioners. And that kind of stuck for a number of years, even though, as you just said, that technically postcoital or emergency contraception can be used. Well, the latest product can be used, I think, something like up to 72 hours after unprotected intercourse. But the morning after pill still has stuck, and there's a group called the Morning After Pill Conspiracy that has continued to use that name as a kind of tongue-in-cheek flippant comment on their activism.
Yeah, interesting. Well, and of course, this kind of relationship between the medical establishment and feminist activists is one of the key themes in your book. And early on, you kind of set us up to think about the relationship between what the medical establishment is seeing as a kind of a what you call a disease paradigm of unwanted pregnancy, and you know thus medication to cure this epidemic, to approach a disease on the one hand, and then you have feminist activists who are concerned with issues of women's autonomy.
Right, so in some cases, the technological development helps women achieve autonomy. Originally, Margaret Sanger wanted a pill that would give women complete control over their fertility. But the scientists that she worked with took a very different approach and were less concerned with women's reproductive rights and more concerned with issues such as poverty in the United States, out of control population growth in the developing world. And so their interest was within limiting fertility, but not necessarily empowering women.
So this, of course, we have the sort of generation, the early generation, right, of people like Margaret Sanger and the scientists battling this out in a way. But it comes up again then in the 1960s when the pill, as we know it, comes onto the market. And we also have these discussions of emergency contraception, but even around the pill itself, you start to have feminists skeptical of the medical establishment, feeling that they're being used as guinea pigs. And I wonder if you can talk, that's a very important chapter in this whole history.
Right. And much of this grew out of the work of investigative journalist Barbara Seaman, who published one of the first exposés on the dangers of the pill called The Doctor's Case Against the Pill in the late 1960s. And that led to a series of congressional hearings on the pill, on estrogen replacement therapy, on Depo-Provera, the use of human subjects more generally. There were hearings on the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, the experiment of untreated syphilis in the African-American male. But part of those hearings also included testimony from women who had been exposed to other drugs and not fully informed of the possible side effects and dangers.
So what kind of information was getting out about side effects and what kind of dangers were we concerned about?
This is the days before patients were fully informed. This is before the FDA mandated that there would be a patient package insert that for patients. So usually information about side effects and contraindications were communicated directly from the drug company to the physician, and it was up to the physician to communicate that to the patients. And some physicians did, but given the relationship between doctors and patients prior to the 1970s, doctors gave the patient what they thought the patient needed to know and then withheld things that they figured would interfere with patient compliance or were not necessary for the patient to understand. And things were worse with female patients because male doctors figured that female patients were stupid. And if they would stop taking drugs if they heard anything that might possibly alarm them. So again, it's a product of the paternalism and entrenched sexism of the medical profession at this time.
So how are how are feminist advocates sort of organizing or articulating their concerns about this pattern? And like you say, their objections to paternalism and the possible consequences of that, having information withheld that might in fact be dangerous to women's health. You talk about the emergence of certain organizations, for example, that are going to become important in your story.
Right. One of the more well-known organizations is the Boston Women's Health Collective, which were the authors of Our Bodies, Ourselves. And they were very much interested in putting together scientific but easy to accessible information for women so that they could feel empowered to ask the right questions, to find practitioners who were interested in treating them as intelligent human beings instead of infantilizing them. And then the National Women's Health Network, which got started in the mid-1970s, was, I think, a more self-consciously political activist group that was criticizing the experimental protocols of drug companies, of scientists who were funded by the National Institutes of Health, were critical of the fact that it was always women who were the subject of testing new reproductive drugs. They asked, well, why are men not being, why isn't there a male pill? Why isn't there contraceptives aimed at men? And of course, part of the reason is that Margaret Sanger wanted contraception to be totally in the hands of women. So, so it's kind of a complex story, but certainly organizations like the National Women's Health Network were on target in showing that in some cases the paternalism of the medical profession tended to overlook some of the genuine interests of the patients in terms of safety and fully informed consent about possible risks and side effects.
So this this discussion is pretty lively in the 1970s, right? That's when you start to get to publications like Our Bodies Ourselves, a very, very lively feminist healthcare movement. Where are we now with emergency contraception at this point?
Well, there's still, if you're interested in following the ins and outs of where current practitioners and policy are, there's a group called the International Consortium on Emergency Contraception, and there's a subgroup called the American Society for Emergency Contraception that was organized in the late 90s to address issues particular to the United States. So right now we're still at an impasse in terms of over-the-counter access to the latest emergency contraceptive product, Plan B One Step. And so far, the age restrictions are still in place. So you have to be 17 or older and show an ID in order to get Plan B One Step over the counter. And then the most recently approved new emergency contraceptive product, Ella-1, which contains a different chemical compound than Plan B One Step, I don't think is available over the counter yet. It was just approved by FDA, and I think there was a separate process by which you get approval to make a drug available over the counter. So there's products available, but it's still difficult to get access to them, particularly if you are a teenager. And it's part of, as you know, the complex politics of reproduction in the United States. And I'm very discouraged with what's been happening with the Republican primary and talk about getting rid of Planned Parenthood. We have one candidate who says contraceptive is wrong, even for married couples. So it's pretty discouraging.
Well, it's interesting because, what we get in your book is a longer-term history of scientific discussions, of political discussions, of social networking, activism, and so on and so forth. And I want to take us back for just a moment before we get to the present situation, because what we've been talking about before really was a world in which emergency contraception, like the birth control pill, was prescription only.
Right.
And where do we get to those first discussions? It's quite significant that emergency contraception does become available over the counter, although, as you note, with age restrictions. And of course, that doesn't happen with the birth control pill. And there we start to have slightly different alliances that is the relationship between feminist health advocates and the medical community, population planning experts, groups representing women of color. There's some shifting around that happens between the 1970s and the 2000s that seems to be connected with discussions about making an emergency contraception available over the counter while daily oral contraceptives are not.
Right. And that for much of the 1970s, and I'd say 1980s, women's health activists were concerned primarily with safety. And they didn't want to see, they wanted to make sure that women were fully informed about and were protected from serious side effects. So over-the-counter access to ongoing regular oral contraceptives remains controversial even among women's health activists who were willing to accept emergency contraception making emergency contraception available over the counter, but we're concerned enough and still are concerned enough about the possible contraindications and side effects of regular hormonal contraception to suggest that this should remain prescription only, or at least have some way of making sure that women who are at risk for blood clots, women who have high blood pressure, women who smoke or have other other mitigating factors that would make them unsuitable candidates for oral contraceptives. So safety, there's one section of the book where I talk about how to balance finding a balance between safety and choice. And also going on at the same time is that there was a movement beginning in the 90s from partly from drug companies and partly from consumers to make more and more drugs available over the counter. And there's one commentator at the time who describes the rise of what he calls OTC-ness. And so drugs that had been previously available by prescription only started to move to over-the-counter status, starting with certain allergy drugs and medication for heartburn and things like that. So emergency contraception became part of that discussion. But at the same time, some physicians and other health professionals and some people in population organizations suggested that because of the consequences of unwanted pregnancy, particularly among adolescent girls, that the benefits of making oral contraceptives, whether they be regular oral contraceptives or emergency contraceptives, available over the counter outweighed any safety risks. So we have different groups weighing the balance between safety and choice in different ways.
So now we're sort of in a world where rather than a kind of a full tension between the medical establishment, who's, like you say, sort of paternalistic, and feminist healthcare advocates who are concerned about safety and concerned about women being given maybe inadequately tested contraceptives with side effects. Now feminist activists are concerned with access, which of course is an argument for making them more available, right? And likewise, the medical profession, again, if they're concerned about, to use some of the old terminology, an epidemic of non-marital births and so on, again, accessibility is helpful. So it sort of serves to put feminist advocates and the medical establishment on the same side against cultural conservatives, right? And that's where the focus on adolescence really comes in.
Right. And I also should point out that sometimes medical professionals and feminist health activists are the same people. In other words, they're blurring the lines. And as particularly the generation of largely female physicians who came of age during second wave feminism and adopted some of the same principles and wanted to transform the medical profession from the inside, start to talk about, well, the prescription is a form of paternalism, so we should remove the prescription in order to empower women. So they, so female health professionals quite deliberately adopt much of the vocabulary and strategy of second wave feminism and say, well, yes, we're concerned with safety, but if we really want to empower women, we need to remove the barriers to access. And this message became even more intense during the 1980s when there was a backlash against reproductive rights laws that were passed that forbid using federal funds for abortion, increasing clinic violence, the rise of organizations like Operation Rescue, which were confrontational, and all of that led to a lot of rapprochement between organizations and individuals who previously had opposing issues on opposing sides on the issue of contraceptive research and development.
So it's really the 1980s where we see some of this shift in who's allying with whom, as a response to the political threat, basically.
Correct.
So let's get to that era where emergency contraception actually gets over-the-counter status. This is a result of some extensive hearings in the FDA and, of course, quite a lot of politicking in the 2000s. Tell us about that story.
Well, the FDA approved emergency contraception for making available Plan B available without prescription in 2006, but that was after several years of back and forth between FDA and activists. And part of this was the result of President George W. Bush's appointee to FDA, head the FDA, who kept holding this up, and series of hearings, a series of various citizen petitions filed by women's health organizations and reproductive rights organizations. And so the politics of reproductive rights during the presidency of George W. Bush played a huge role in complicating the process of making emergency contraception available over-the-counter in a way that other over-the-counter drugs did not encounter.
So we have advocates from various sides basically petitioning the FDA. We have the medical profession, which as you say, is by now there are a lot of women there who are basically, you know, as feminists within the medical profession, arguing for greater access, feminist organizations, but also socially conservative organizations petitioning against. And this is the Bush presidency. And there's a head of the FDA who sympathizes with cultural conservatives and is concerned with blocking this. So it's quite a politicized process. What makes it finally possible to get it through?
Well, I think partly what happens is that I'm having trouble with my with my microphone. Could you ask that question again?
What makes it possible to finally get OTC status, given the rather hostile environment?
Well, I think part of it is just sheer persistence and also activism by women in Congress who, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who successfully heads up a campaign to block votes on the approval process for Bush appointees until the FDA moves ahead on approving the OTC application for Plan B. So it's persistence, it's confrontational politics. There's a group called the Morning After Pill Conspiracy that marches on Washington as part of the March for Women's Lives. So it's old fashioned, in your face, direct, nonviolent, direct confrontation and persistence by groups across the various medical organizations, non-governmental organizations for reproductive rights, feminist organizations like NOW and Planned Parenthood. So it's just a maelstrom of media attention to the whole issue.
And you know, one thing that interested me when I read this was that, as you say, even now it's not actually available literally over the counter, or that you have to actually go to the counter. It's not like aspirin that you can just pick up off the shelf.
Right.
It's more like cold medicines that can be used to produce meth, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, emergency contraception is one of the few drugs that you can't literally get over the counter. You don't need a prescription, but you still have to go to the pharmacist's desks and ask for it and show an ID showing that you are over the age of 17. And as you mentioned, certain cold remedies containing pseudoepinephrine have been placed behind the counter because they can be used to make crystal meth, and so there's limits on how much you can buy, and also that to prevent shoplifting and so forth. So in a sense, Emergency contraception is in this nebulous category between true over-the-counter drugs, which you can buy, pick off the shelf, and just go pay at the cash register, and prescription drugs.
So, in a sense, you do have there's a bit of potentially an intimidation factor in practical purposes. That is, you have to actually go ask someone who might look at you disapprovingly. Or more seriously, today might claim, reason of conscience, refusal to distribute this in the current environment, if I understand correctly.
Right. And then there's one or two cases of men attempting to purchase emergency contraception and being told that they can't buy it. And I've heard from teenagers that a girl who's 17 or younger needs emergency contraception and her boyfriend is 18. Well, he'll go and buy emergency contraception for her if he can. Part of it is a product of the age restriction, but there's this urban legend that there are rapists out there who are sexual predators who assault young girls and then make them take emergency contraception so they don't get pregnant. And I think that's... If those alleged sexual predators are out there, I have yet to see one, an actual report on one. So,
well, and of course, all of this, at the time you wrote the book, it's a very recent book, but nevertheless, it does predate the current season of presidential electioneering and the discussions about contraceptives more generally.
Right.
And as we know well from reading your book and others, there's a continuous strand of cultural conservatism that's very suspicious of contraceptives and certainly of the notion that teenagers might get their hands on them or unmarried people in general. But beyond that observation, I wonder if you feel that your research into this has given you any special insights into current debates about contraception.
Well, first of all, I have to say that I never see in my lifetime candidates attacking contraception. I can certainly understand how and why abortion remains a political hot potato. But it's amazing to me that in the 21st century that we still have politicians like Rick Santorum saying that contraception is bad. And I know it's part of that comes from the teaching of the Catholic Church, but that's so out of line with what probably the vast majority of Catholics, particularly Catholic women, believe. So it's, the optimistic side of me hopes that Republican candidates are overreaching and that reports of moderate Republican women abandoning the party and voting for their interest in reproductive rights for birth control anyways. I think abortion is going to remain a contentious issue, but it seems to me that if anything continues to affect the political, I think that there's such a large percentage of the American population that considers birth control, access to contraception, not just a right, that this is something that has been established as a right that all people in the United States deserve. And I think if you'd ask, not being a parent myself, but I think parents of teenagers might agree that preventing pregnancy is better than the alternative. So at least I would hope that.
And, one thing that comes through loud and clear in your book is, of course, the distinction between rights and actual access. And this is something we think about quite frequently when we think about abortion. Yes, there's a right to abortion, but there are states in which, the majority of the population has to drive 3 or 6 hours to get to the nearest actual provider, 24-hour waiting periods, and so access is made difficult. And here in your book, we have that kind of on a more humble scale. But again, the business of having to go show an ID, having to present yourself directly face to face with a pharmacist to actually get the pill rather than being able to, you know, again, pluck it off the shelves of the drugstore. It's a kind of a more quotidian, you know, way of thinking of the possible limits to access. But of course, we do hear more and more about a language saying that, you know, pharmacists perhaps can excuse themselves from dispensing medications that they morally object to.
And you know, part of it is that sort of access. But another barrier is cost. One of the things that's happened with over-the-counter drugs more generally is that they tend to be as expensive, if not more expensive, than prescription drugs, and they're usually not covered by health insurance. So anybody who thinks that there are women and girls out there who use emergency contraception every time they have sex need to understand that I think Plan B one step costs something like $50 or $60, and that might be lowballing it. So whereas a package of oral contraceptives costs considerably less than that. So I don't know. I have health insurance. But so one of the, I guess, the ironies of the move to over-the-counter status is that for women of low income, it's actually made it more expensive to use emergency contraception. And so what some clinics continue to do is you can get, if you go to, say, Planned Parenthood or a clinic that's funded by federal Title X funds, then you can get emergency contraception and oral contraceptives at reduced cost. So, but that means you have to go and make an appointment, see a doctor, and that. So there are economic barriers that need to be considered as well. And so another alarming thing that's happening with all the debates about the Healthcare Reform Act is who is going to pay for contraception. And the discussion is about prescription drugs, but there's no discussion about non-prescription drugs. So if you really want to talk about access, you also need to talk about economic access as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I myself hadn't realized that dollar figure for emergency contraception. And of course, there is, you know, as we see in the history of discussions of emergency contraception, you know, concern that women will just use this as their contraceptive. And, you know, if coming from a couple of different sides, you know, from cultural conservatives who thinks it's a ticket to, you know, irresponsibility, but also to medical professionals and feminist health advocates who are, you know, concerned about side effects. This is not something you want to be taking a couple of times a week.
Right.
But as you say, the cost factor might make that discussion very well just moot from the beginning.
Right.
This is, you know, an incredibly contemporary book. I mean, even, you know, within the last couple of years, of course, the discussions of what the age barrier should be, you know, this is something that's really quite current, you know, 18, 17, 16, you know, this is all within our very recent memory. Never mind, as you note, that now expanded discussions of contraceptives, period. So it's very interesting to read this, you know, given our current political climate and discussions. Let me ask you sort of our traditional wrap-up question for listeners who are interested in your work. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm kind of trying to formulate my next project, but in terms of a monograph. But what I'd like to do in the near future is put together a symposium for the 50th anniversary of the Griswold versus Connecticut decision in 1965, which was the first time that the Supreme Court recognized a right to privacy, at least in terms of marital situations. So that was the decision that overturned laws in Connecticut and other states that prohibited married individuals from obtaining contraception. And so that kind of formed the basis for the notion of a right to privacy that was later extended to abortion in Roe v. Wade. And Griswold tends to be seen as a precursor to Roe, and I'd sort of like to have some kind of commemorative symposium that explores the Griswold decision on its own terms. And since I'm in Connecticut and we have pretty strong organizations for Connecticut history, including a journal and institutions like Yale, which have pretty strong graduate history programs, in the University of Connecticut as well. So that's what I'm kind of entertaining for the short term. And I'd like in some way to continue looking at the history of feminist activism and reproductive technology. But at the moment, it's kind of, I'm still trying to formulate how I go about doing that.
Interesting. Yeah, because of course we are coming up on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And right. That can say shortly thereafter, the 50th anniversary of Griswold.
Actually, it's sooner. It's next year because Roe v. Wade right. is 1973. So
right. yeah.
I'm going to let Texas deal with it. Oh. I'm sure there's probably somebody who's already working on
something in the works. Yeah. Yeah. So this is very, very interesting stuff, and I'm grateful you took the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks so much. We've been talking to Heather Munro Prescott about her new book, The Morning After, A History of Emergency Contraception in the United States. Thanks again, Heather.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Heather Munro Prescott, author of The Morning After, A History of Emergency Contraception in the United States. I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies. Thanks for joining us today.